broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria. You're listening to the Investor Exchange. Tune in each week and listen to the guys from United Global Capital discuss the topics that matter the most to your finances. Each episode will help you separate the noise from what really matters, giving you timely and actionable information you can use. We'll cover areas related to financial markets, property, politics, personal finance, and the economy. Now, here's your host, Stephanie Sumner.
And very good morning to all of our listeners, and good morning here in the studio, guys. Welcome.
Good morning, Steph.
Good morning.
Here we go again.
Yeah, we do. Now, Louis, you had a great weekend last weekend in Perth?
Oh, I did, yeah. It was a lovely reunion with old high school friends. It's been a long time since I've seen a lot of them. Yeah. And interesting to see how people's faces change from the age of 17 to 37.
Was there a lot in a good way or a bad way?
Well,
they might be some of your listeners. So.
More mature, more sophisticated.
Absolutely, mature, sophisticated. Yeah. I went to an all-boys school. Everyone was very handsome.
Yep.
Yes. A few that were difficult to recognise.
Wow.
A lot more facial hair?
A lot more facial hair. Yep. A few baldies.
Oh, yeah.
And one or two stories of people going bald and then reclaiming their hair. Apparently the treatments do work.
Okay.
And that made some of the baldies very excited.
I've got a good mate of mine. He'll go unnamed, but I've got a good mate of mine who went bald or was going bald and shaved his hair off and then... we saw him 1 week and he had no hair, and then the next week he had the full head of hair, and I'm like, what the hell happened here?
That's a rug.
He did look good though, I'm going to say. It really did look good. And it looked very realistic. So
yeah. Excellent. Right. Yeah. Is that the carpet approach?
Well, it was pretty full.
Like very
yeah,
lush.
Yeah. Lush, yeah.
Excellent,
yeah.
Excellent.
And within a week, that's a rug for sure.
Yep. Silky smooth hair that you can't touch.
Yep.
But it did look good.
Weekend, guys? Doing anything fun? I think, Brett, you're off down to Port.
Yeah, heading down the beach to Freeze for a day. So that'll be nice. Get me out of town.
Winter at the beach.
Yep.
Beautiful.
Nice.
Yep. I'll be having an indoors weekend.
Yes, yeah, so you're not feeling taking too well. Was it obviously
bit under
too
the
much
weather
fun?
Now. That's right, yeah.
Pushing it too hard into the 30th of June, hey?
Oh, well, yeah, there's that. And
a bit of partying.
A bit of partying, yeah. You know, I can't go for 3 days in a row of late nights.
It takes an impact
on my body, yeah.
Yeah.
And Joel, football for you?
It's bye week this week. So I'll probably go for a motorbike ride, I'd say, on Sunday and see how we go.
Just hope you don't break your wrists.
Can't wait to see these photos Saturday night.
Did explain to him the next time he has an injury, I will be getting in a male nurse to look after him.
Yeah.
That could actually be something fun to do. To post. I've got a couple of photos of you, Joel, out there. Yeah. Maybe one or two of those could be posted.
I haven't actually been all that successful this year on the bike. For those listeners who don't know, I broke both my wrists earlier this year. Trying to be a hero, and then 2 weeks ago we ended up down in this big valley that we couldn't get out of, and spent the next 4.5 hours pushing 3 motorbikes over logs and trees.
Excellent for your health.
It's good work.
Good for your fitness.
I felt like I was Arnold Schwarzenegger in the jungle in Predator.
Yeah.
You're in a world of hurt out here.
Sure, he looked like that too.
Yeah, it looked exactly like that.
All right, well, guys, we're going to kick off our first topic for today when everyone's had their Schwarzenegger impersonations done.
Very good.
But, Louis, we're going to throw to you, and you're going to speak to us today about how people might lose their life insurance through super on the 1st of July. Tell us more about that.
This is a timely topic, and the message to all of our listeners is please read the letters from your super fund. Normally I'd tell you, you can probably ignore them, but this one... Please open that envelope and read the letter that's inside, because there is new legislation coming in. It was passed in Parliament back in February, and the legislation is that on the 1st of July this year, any default life insurance that was put in place by the super fund will be cancelled if your account is deemed to be inactive.
To make your account inactive.
So if there's been no activity on your account, so no contributions into the account, or no rollovers in or out on the account, then it can be deemed to be inactive.
So would that be more people that are retired? What would make your account sort of inactive? Because I would be thinking that we put money in all the time.
Yeah, so. good question. But think of most people who... not most people, but a lot of people who might have more than one super fund.
Okay.
And if you have just done that by accident and you haven't been paying attention, well, then... you probably haven't had a review of how much insurance you need. But for other people and for a good number of our clients, we did an insurance review and we decided, no, we need that default insurance cover that's in place with your current fund, but still set up a self-managed super fund to hold up most of your balance and do good investments, but keep that current fund in place just for the insurance that's there. Mm-hmm. So we want that insurance to stay there. So for a lot of people, they will intentionally have two or three or four super funds. But there's other circumstances, like a person who is out of the workforce for a period of time. They might have been on maternity leave. They might have been overseas. They might have taken a contract role where they don't receive automatic super contributions. So there's a few reasons why a person could easily go for a year or 2 years with no contributions to their super. So the requirement is you should just be able to respond to that letter with an opt-in.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But you may need to make a small contribution into that super fund.
What's the period that deems it inactive? How long?
It's
16 months, I think.
16 months, but there's actually two things happening at the same time, and that 16 months might get confusing. So 16 months is the rule of thumb, but you got to read that letter from your super fund because there may be variations between funds.
Okay.
So the legislation might be a certain period of time, but a particular super fund might take a different view of a shorter period of time, but still within legislation.
Right. Mm. And why, Louis, was this legislation brought in? Why are they doing it?
They're doing it because of the people who don't pay attention, who rack up multiple super funds and have the cost of life insurance erode their superannuation balance.
Right.
Unfortunately, it's come from the economists' view, who say, well, there is a large amount of population who don't pay attention to their super, who have these default insurances, and economically speaking and statistically speaking, people's superannuation balances would be higher if the default insurances were cancelled.
Okay.
But that completely disregards the actual value of the insurance, also disregards that Australia has a chronic under insurance problem. If you look at the amount of insurance that most people have automatically placed on their super fund by default, you'll commonly find it's maybe $50,000 to $250,000 of life insurance and disability insurance and maybe income protection. But for any parent, very rarely am I recommending life insurance of less than $1 million.
Wow.
Because by the time you pay off a home loan and leave enough funds for the living expenses of a surviving spouse and child, $1 million is...
Not much.
Doesn't go far these days.
Doesn't go very far.
But what about, life insurance is obviously important, but having it in your super account like that, should you be doing it like that, or should you really go and get your own sort of insurance elsewhere? I mean, what's the best way to do it?
It could be better paying for it directly, or it could be better paying for it through your super fund. Mm-hmm. So again, if you actually pay attention to it and consciously review what is the insurance I need, what is the insurance I've got, well, then you can get advice or you can make an informed decision. Well, this is the insurance that I want to have.
Yeah.
The problem is there is a very big part of the population that never gets around to it.
Oh, because I totally agree. I mean, mine was just put on my super account back in the day and I never looked at it again. So.
Yep, that's right.
And I would just think that it would just kick in when something goes wrong or when I need it. So.
Exactly, yeah. And that's like a lot of people out there and they don't have enough insurance.
Right.
And this is a level of protection, but it's a level of protection that is going to be lost for a lot of people, unfortunately. In my career in financial planning, I've put in place a lot of insurance policies for people, and some of those people have come back and had to claim on their insurance because of death or disability, but I've processed far more claims on people that have come to me to claim on their default insurance than I have on any insurance policies that I've put in place.
Okay,
right. Yeah.
So that default insurance is absolutely valuable and has changed the lives of a number of people who were not my client until they came to me with a medical condition saying, what do I do?
Mm. Mm.
And we went to their super fund and we saw that there was this default insurance, and therefore, great, we can actually get you an extra $200,000, $300,000 to help you through the rest of your life now that you're never going to work again,
right,
or you're going to be in a wheelchair for the rest of your life, mm, or you've got multiple sclerosis and it's deteriorated and you're going to struggle.
Mm.
Okay. So, I mean, that's something that everyone should take into consideration, but it is a lot of money. I mean, people sort of look at it and go, oh, insurance will cost me a fortune. So you're saying sort of you can have this default on your, mm-hmm, super account, or, you know, how do I go to compare it? Is it best to go to a financial advisor to get the best advice, or how would I compare those funds?
Yeah, great question. Always get expert advice. And this comes across, I mean, yes, I'm biased because I am an expert, mm, and I want to help people, but I have that theory for anything that's worth doing. If you're going to start an exercise program or a new diet, get expert advice so that you're actually making quality decisions and getting an appropriate solution for you.
Yeah, sorry. So, Louis, so just to clarify, it's only applicable to the default insurance. If you've gone and received advice from an advisor and you've put in place insurances through your superannuation fund that weren't, you know, that were selected personally, then that insurance will continue.
It's being reported that it's only on default insurance,
right,
but pay attention to those letters, yeah, that you get from the super fund, because I am getting queries from people who are getting letters from their super funds, and we put in place the insurance ourselves. We,
yeah,
intentionally, it was not default insurance,
yeah,
but they're still getting these letters from their super funds.
Yep.
So you have to read those letters that are coming, because the legislation is one thing, but then
what the super funds do,
what the super fund trustee actually does, mm, is within their discretion.
Right.
Mm.
So you've got to read those letters that are coming from the super fund.
I assume that'll be different for different super funds themselves, or we'd have to call and...
Correct. And they'll all have a different opt-in procedure.
Sure.
Some of them might not be an opt-in. They might require a contribution. So you might it might only be $20 just,
mm,
to get a contribution, a transaction listed on your account,
mm,
which will then say, no, it's active. All right, let's get the BPAY details and let's just throw $20 into super just to keep that insurance in place.
Right.
Now, it's coinciding with another rule change, and this is where a bit of confusion about the balance of the super fund comes into account. So a super fund can be deemed to be inactive no matter what the balance.
Mm, okay.
So even if you've got hundreds of thousands in the super fund, it can still be deemed inactive, and you can still lose that insurance. But in addition to that, if it is a balance that's less than 6,000, not only do you lose the insurance, but it can be transferred to the ATO.
The actual super fund balance.
The whole super fund balance, and they can just close the account and send it off to the ATO.
Now, that doesn't mean that the money is gone. It just means that you'll need to do the rollover from the ATO.
Correct.
Hold,
that's right. The ATO will hold on to that money,
yep,
for you. Probably won't get any interest or return on it.
No, but then absolutely not.
But then it won't get eroded
by...
They will.
Won't get eroded by fees.
That's right, but it won't be eroded by fees.
Yeah.
But it is a bit of a grab by the government, because, yeah, there is billions of dollars in these,
yeah,
small balance super funds that are inactive, and, mm, the government wants that to sit on their balance sheet.
Sure.
They're happy to give it back to you when you claim it, but there is a lot of unclaimed money,
mm,
that's there, and the government wants to have it in their hands.
Yeah.
Isn't there an online portal, Louis, that the average person can go to and find most of their lost super or unclaimed?
It's now getting easier and easier. So when you do your tax return and you do it online and you get a MyGov,
yeah,
account, through your MyGov account, which is then linked to the ATO,
mm,
you can actually find a list of all of your super funds.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yep,
when a balance under 6,000 is consolidated, these days it is much easier to find than it has been in the past.
Another question too, though, if you do lose the life insurance, does that mean you get a rebate for that money, or is it just forget?
No, there's no refund on past premiums.
Right.
It's only that the future expense won't be charged.
Wow.
Because the insurance is gone.
Got to really pay attention.
You got to really pay attention, but you can go back and claim retrospectively.
Okay.
So if your insurance is lost on the 1st of July. And then, but you didn't know about it.
Mm.
And then on the 1st of September, you realise, hang on,
yeah, it's gone.
This person actually passed away
yeah.
6 months ago, or this person actually became disabled 6 months ago, and we didn't know the insurance was there. It's now been cancelled, but the disability or death event happened while the insurance was in place.
Right.
Yeah.
There can be grounds to claim on an insurance policy even if it's been cancelled since.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So everyone put a note into your email calendars if mm-hmm. you have that super fund and that insurance, and make sure you watch.
Check now, your super funds, please.
Just a little bit further on that, a lot of that default insurance in many instances is actually a lot cheaper as well than what you would get if it was personal insurance that you went and sought yourself. So even if you are, even if you have received advice or you're planning on getting advice around your insurances, often that default insurance could be a core component of your insurance protection strategy because of the group policy nature of those insurances.
Mm.
And for those people who aren't aware, a group insurance policy is essentially where an insurance company makes an assessment on the group of members of that fund and applies a broad risk pricing to that group of members rather than individually assessing you on a case-by-case basis.
Mm. I would say that some people out there might have a negative perception about insurance advisors, and historically an insurance advisor would probably have said, just cancel what you've got and take what I'm selling because I want to sell you insurance.
Sure.
But what is in place these days are laws where a financial advisor has to give you a statement of advice,
mm-hmm.
and that statement of advice has to clearly explain why a new insurance policy is different or better or worse in any way than your current insurance.
Right.
So it needs to be very clear that this is your current policy and this is the replacement policy. The replacement policy has these features which are better than the current, and the current policy has these features which are better than the replacement.
Mm.
And here is the basis of our recommendation.
Yeah. And what I was just going to ask too, if you've already got the default insurance in there, is it sort of timely to actually contact your super fund too and say, well, mine's just at a limited amount. Should I be looking to up it? Considering that you're saying that it's not enough really to cover events that happen in life that could really wipe you out.
So. Absolutely. Most people who look will find that their life insurance is probably not enough to cover their mortgage.
Yeah.
Standard amount of life insurance around $200,000 to $250,000. The average mortgage around
It has to be $300,000 to $400,000, I'd say.
$300,000 to $400,000 for people who have owned property for a while,
yeah.
and people getting into the property market now, I would say
probably getting up to probably $600,000 or $700,000.
Very easily $500,000 plus.
Mm.
There's just not enough life insurance to even cover the mortgage.
Wow. Scary stuff.
It is.
Mm.
Pay attention.
Absolutely. Yeah. All right, guys, we're going to throw to a really quick break and we'll be back after this message.
Want to learn the strategies that have achieved returns more than double the return of the average superannuation fund? Each day, clients of United Global Capital are using strategies and tactics that were once thought the domain of the professional investor or the super rich. Book your seat at UGC's Financial Fast Track Seminars, where you'll learn the science behind selecting high-performance stocks and real estate, how you can participate in advanced strategies like property development, short selling, and international investments, as well as how to protect your wealth against major adverse market events. To secure your seat, simply go to ugc.net.au/events and select the seminar that suits your needs. Seats are limited, so book your spot now.
And welcome back, guys. We're going to head on to the next topic for today, and we're going to throw over to Brett, who's going to talk about the fifth largest lender. Tell us more, Brett.
Well, I'm going to actually ask if you guys can figure that out. But before you answer that, I just want to say that this comes off the back of two announcements I noticed this week from APRA. Right. I don't know whether you guys saw this.
No, haven't.
First one I thought we'd touch on because it comes back to topics we've discussed recently. So after, obviously, the Royal Commission and all of the recommendations and things coming through, they're now starting to implement. And one of the things I saw was announced, in fact, I only saw it this morning, that they have issued directions and additional license conditions to AMP superannuation.
Really?
Oh, have they now?
Yeah. There we go. So I haven't read the full article, but I just noticed that's happened as of this morning.
I think I mentioned to you the other week that Kenneth Hain comes down to our gym. I actually had a bit of a brief conversation with him yesterday.
Oh, you did? Yeah. Oh, so yeah. You've seen him regularly
Do you compliment him on his bicep curls?
Joel got very excited. It was like a celebrity sighting for Joel.
No one else knew who it was.
No, I didn't. It's like, look.
We were swapping stories about how this exercise first thing in the morning is supposed to be good for the soul. I said, I call bullshit on that.
He's very fit, though. I'll give him that.
He is.
Okay. Mentally and physically, I'd imagine.
The fittest commissioner in our history, would you say, Steph?
I think so.
No. Easy, Tiger.
Love a man in a curly wig.
Yeah. Oh, the wigs can't get away from him today.
It was just shorts at the gym, actually.
No, So the other announcement was in regard to capital guidelines for the large and small banks in regard to what they deem risky loans.
Right.
Okay.
So they've shifted. Well, it's not implemented, but they're saying by 2022, what the changes with the capital guidelines and the reserves are going to shift according to the impact of risk weights.
Yep.
Okay. As they call it.
Yep.
So change is coming. But I wanted to link that because obviously, with the moving landscape of APRA putting on to most of the major banks with their lending, there is the fifth biggest lender. So obviously the four biggest are the four majors we're aware of. Does anyone know who the fifth biggest is?
No idea.
Well, I'm going to take a punt.
Yep.
I'm going to say it's actually La Trobe.
Good guess, but it's not where we're heading here.
Are you including subsidiary banks within?
I'll include any source of lending you can think of.
Okay. Because
if private lenders.
If you're separating subsidiaries, I would say the St. George Group.
Mm-hmm.
They're owned by Westpac, but as a group, that's St. George, Bank of Melbourne, Bank SA. I'd say they're the fifth.
Well, I've done a bit of smoke and mirrors here. I've actually deceived you all a little bit because the terminology, the fifth largest source of lending in Australia behind the big four.
Oh, okay.
Does that change the way you think about it?
Oh, is it?
Oh, okay, I'm going to say private lenders.
Well, that's pretty much accurate, but it's what otherwise known as...
GE? GE, the credit finance and business finance.
No, Joel's closer to the answer I'm looking for here.
Of course I am.
There's only room for one ego here, Joel, and that's mine.
Attitude this morning.
So the answer I'm looking for is commonly referred to as the Bank of Mum and Dad.
Oh,
really? Yeah. There we go.
Suckers. So, apparently the stats from 2017 identified family members, so essentially the Bank of Mum and Dad, as being the fifth largest source of lending in Australia behind the big four.
Poor buggers.
Okay. Yeah. And I wanted to ask the question if anyone has had experience with either a client or personally or people they know using this source, because the article I read that brought it to my attention is from a local law firm that said it's important to really be aware of how these come about because of the risks associated with
we've,
how
we've
these
heard a few horror
gifts
stories
versus
with that.
Loans,
so
to speak. So they've got a whole list of advice, but before I sort of go into the details, they've said, has anyone, Louis, have you had a client that's got this scenario?
Yeah.
Either as the lender or the lender?
Look, we see it pretty commonly, actually. Yep. So we see it in clients who have started a business or just needed help out of a financial situation. We also see clients who have lent to parents who are in retirement and just, we're happy to help and it's down as a loan. And that can be problematic when it comes to the estate planning because if nothing's in writing... then, child number one, they need their $100,000 back before the estate is split up between child one, two, three, and four. Mm. And it also has an implication in an aged care situation, and we can actually use family loans in a good way in some instances to manage a potential future aged care entry.
Mm. Yeah, right. Mm.
So I would imagine, you know, if you're the borrower or the lender, this does need to come into your financial plan and have some strategy and documentation around it if you're going to participate in this.
Yeah, definitely needs some strategy. Because a lot of people haven't outlined the terms. Mm. So when's it going to be paid back? How much is going to be paid back? Is it every month? Is it every year a repayment? Is there interest? And then if it's not in writing, well, then the terms can change and there can be uncertainty. And if there's a death or disability, well, the lack of documentation is...
Yeah.
A real problem.
Are you reading what I've already got in front of me here, Louis? Because you're touching on most of the points that this law firm outlined.
Right.
Must have x-ray vision.
Yeah, must have. No, but very, very relevant. Shows you know your stuff, Louis, of course.
Thanks.
So I'll tell you what the law firm has highlighted. So they said there are two really common concerns that they see, and it's what happens if there's a relationship breakdown is a key one, and what happens if the business plans don't work out. And they stress that you know there's a difference between gifting versus lending, and they're talking about making sure when the money is lent within the family, they make sure it is lending and documented appropriately as a loan. So they say that some of the things that happen that can come about to cause failure of the payback of the loan is that the creditors having access to those funds in the event of the borrower going bankrupt, that the gift is being included in the property pool if it's used for a property purchase, and in the event that there's a relationship breakdown, marriage or de facto, that you know the parents of the partner that loaned the money, you know, it's just then given to both of the the partners. Yeah, it's an equal split rather than saying, well, that was my parents' money. It's really got to come back this way. And not being able to call the money back if it is needed in the future. So if it was parents needing it for their retirement needs or anything else, they don't have a right to call it back if needed. So they were the major things they said to be aware of.
I think it's just one of those really awkward conversations when you're a parent to have to say to them, I want to document this. And I know it's, you know, it's off, you know, you need to do it, but it's just an awkward... It's just awkward.
Can be.
Yeah.
It's awkward for some people, Steph.
Yeah.
But different people and families have different personalities.
Yeah,
so
that's true.
Some, you know, there are amazingly people who have good filing systems and good record keeping habits. So it's worth just bringing up that slightly awkward thing and saying, well, let's just have a piece of paper around it.
Well, I guess it's like any other legal transaction that you are involved with. Just because it's family, I guess you still need it written up and, you know, you have to sort of get over that to make sure that everyone is protected in that.
Yeah, and especially because... if there's a verbal conversation, people remember conversations differently.
Yeah, that's true.
And if you're talking about a loan, then you're trying to remember a conversation that's probably from years ago. Memories are fallible.
I can think of two instances where clients in this firm have lent money under terms that they... swear by, only for the other party to say, no, that's not what we agreed
to. That's
not
the agreement, yeah.
Exactly.
And I've also had a friend that's recently separated and had an arrangement where some money was passed over for them to buy a house. And the parent wanted the money back, even though one of them was putting in a lot of contributions towards the other person's life. So it's been an awkward situation. So again, nothing written up. And it turned quite ugly.
And the challenging situation if it's helping to buy a home is often the bank will require a declaration that it is a non-refundable gift. So if that's in writing, well then you can't put a loan agreement in writing and have the two both be valid.
So is it best to go and see a lawyer when you're doing this kind of thing, or is it just do it yourself?
You probably don't even need to see a lawyer. Maybe just not. As long as you're outline the general terms and you both sign it and there's a consensus.
Is
there
it binding though if you do it yourself?
Absolutely, yeah, contract. Yeah.
You can just do it yourself. You don't need any...
Contract law doesn't require you to have a lawyer to draft up the contract. It's just as long as it's there's an agreement. In fact, contracts are binding even if they're verbal under law, but it just makes it easier to prove when you've got it written down on paper.
And ensure everyone agrees that that's what was agreed to.
Same as you can write your will on a napkin,
yep.
You can write a contract on a napkin, and it's legally binding. It's a record of what was said at the time.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, Steph, there is some advice that this law firm gives about how to document it. So they said the biggest four keys they suggest is have a formal loan agreement document. Mm-hmm. So have something, as we're alluding to here. Have an agreement of some sort.
And you can get plenty of them off the internet. Yeah, there's templates everywhere.
Yeah. Okay. They suggest that there are repayments being made on a regular basis, mm-hmm. so it shows evidence of it. Ideally, security being taken over the property. Mm-hmm. And the last one is an acknowledgement from the child's partner that the loan is a loan and not a gift.
Okay.
They say those, they're the four major things I would like to see written down to allow it. So they say that, look, a lot of practical matters to consider, but Louis, you mentioned one before that they've highlighted as well. The potential impact a loan may have on the child's ability to service an existing loan or obtain finance. As you said, if it's a gift versus a loan, it changes whether they'll get that loan approval.
Yep.
So that's one of the factors. And they also suggest checking out if any adjustments are required to your wills to take the loan into account.
Mm. That's another thing. Mm. Updating your will. I mean, who's got a will? I've got to put one in place.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Everyone got one?
No, we shouldn't.
No.
You know what? That's another really awkward conversation, right? Yeah. Joel and I were talking about that the other day. It's awkward because you're basically thinking of your mortality. So.
Yeah, no thanks.
Yeah, but you have to, right? Yeah. It's a little bit like writing up a contract for what we're talking about at the moment.
Mm.
But no one here has a will.
Yeah. Look, in some instances, though, and Steph, I can probably say this with quite confidence, that the laws of intestacy can actually serve pretty well for simple situations.
Simple situations, Joel.
Yeah.
But it's when you want to start to deal with more complex matters that definitely you need to get that stuff sorted
Absolutely.
Out.
Absolutely. Mm. And what happens if the both of us go? You know, where does it go?
Intestacy passes it to other relatives.
Yeah,
yes.
But you've got to remember
order.
How you want it split up, right?
Well, you want it split up differently.
That's
to,
right. How
to
they
the
would
laws
probably
of your
do
state.
It.
Yeah.
Victoria's just done a big overhaul of their intestacy and their disputes.
Sorry, the word intestacy.
Intestacy. Yes. Sorry, there's too many testes. But other states I'm not sure of.
Yeah.
So other states in Australia could well still have some pretty archaic rules.
Mm.
Rules like the first 50,000 of an estate goes to the spouse, but then the remaining amount is split equally between spouse and children.
Mm.
And if you've got a one-year-old child, there's
That's
no
right.
point to a child having, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars
Sitting
inherited.
Around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yep.
So while you're checking your super...
Oh, well, you're checking your super, checking your law, contract law,
we'll
and
make
loans
sure you do a will.
Yeah.
I'm going to come back, actually. They're going to circle back on that topic in a few weeks' time to see if anyone's followed up. There are simple will kits that you can get your hands on.
Yes.
So
oh, thank you, Steph.
Let's
oh,
do it.
Good,
okay.
good call. Right. Yeah. Well, look, it wasn't anything more than that. I guess the only part of it I thought we haven't touched on is, given that, you know, a lot of younger people trying to get into the property market are feeling priced out, I think that this is going to be prevalent for a number of people that may be listening and going forward. It's going to continue to be, you know, if they're the fifth largest source of lending as of 2017, I would imagine that's going to remain pretty much the same going forward.
I'm sure.
So just do it appropriately.
Yeah. Good advice. All right, we're going to take another short break and we'll be back after this message.
Are you concerned about your finances? Maybe you're not sure if you'll have enough money to retire on. Or maybe you've received a redundancy, inheritance, or even a significant promotion, or perhaps a life-changing medical diagnosis. Regardless of your concern or financial position, United Global Capital's advisors are experts in the areas of strategic financial planning, taxation, superannuation and self-managed superannuation funds, risk management, estate planning, and investments. Don't let fate dictate your financial future. Take control today and contact United Global Capital for a no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Simply call 03 8657 7640 or email info@ugc.net.au and book your appointment today.
Okay, and welcome back, guys. And we're going to head to the last topic for today. We're going to throw over to Joel, and you're going to talk about the winner's strategy and scaling into position.
Oh, that must be the Collingwood strategy.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, what did you win last year?
The wooden spoon.
No,
you weren't that bad.
Not quite.
You won a lot of games last year.
Yeah,
good on you. Okay.
It's very nice of you,
Louis. The most improved.
Go and get nicked. All right. Well, look, just a very brief one today, but I thought it was worthwhile raising in that, look, Paul Tudor Jones, does anyone know who Paul Tudor Jones is?
Can't say I do.
He's a $4.6 billion hedge fund manager, so he's worth about $4.6 billion. Okay. And he also married an Australian, a former Australian model and now yoga entrepreneur.
Of course he did.
Okay.
Living the life.
Yeah. It's easy to be zen when you've got $4.6 billion.
It's easy to marry a model too. Yeah. Yeah. That does Pilates and yoga.
Now, he was being interviewed by CNBC earlier this week, and he was in line with some of the commentary that came out over the last couple of weeks. Our view of a fairly positive outlook for stocks and AusCap, the fund manager that we went to last week, and their view of a positive outlook for stocks going forward. We actually made some recommendations to clients. Which is what we call, well, what Louis has dubbed the winner's strategy.
You dubbed it to me first.
Also known as what we call scaling into winning positions. Now this
doesn't have the same ring.
It's hard. This is why investing in the stock market is so hard. It is so counterintuitive to everything that you would think is the right thing to do. So in the stock market, you're told to be greedy when everyone else is fearful. So naturally, you've got to do what everyone else is telling you not to do or is scared of.
Yep.
You're told to be fearful when everyone else is greedy. So once again, you're trying to take money off when it seems as though like nothing can go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You should be actually buying into stocks that are going up rather than trying to pick bottoms and try and be a hero. But the human psychology says, well, hey, I'm a hero here. I reckon this is the bottom and I'm going to get in. And before you know it, the stock keeps falling. And you should be adding to strength, which goes against every grain in your body. When you start to see a profit, all you want to do is make sure that you lock that profit in and not give it back. But in actual fact, the way that most successful investors generate that additional extra 2 or 3% per annum out of their portfolio is by putting more money into the stocks that are going up and actually making money for them and getting rid of the stocks that are actually losing money for them and cutting their losses. So we actually just did that this week. There were 5 stocks in our portfolio that we actually added to. Now, we're up on average anywhere between sort of 15 to 30% in some of these positions, and we've actually just added more money into them. So we start with around about a 2.5% allocation to all of our investments. And as these stocks start to move in the direction that our investment thesis indicates, and they start to form that uptrend that we're expecting, or that uptrend starts to fatten out a little bit, we actually added more money to those positions. And it's a great way to actually capture the body of the trend. So stocks will always go through periods where they go up, they go sideways, or they go down. Now, what we're trying to obviously do is capture the meat of the trend. Now, stocks only really sort of trend around about 25% of the time. The rest of the time, they're in these up and down, sideways, sort of, going nowhere patterns. But when they do move, that's the time that you want to be actually putting more money into them. When you've got that confidence that the trend is actually developing, that your investment thesis is playing out, that the fundamentals and the reports that the company are releasing are in line with that investment thesis. Because that can be a really powerful way to add an extra few percentage points to your portfolio. That doesn't mean, though, that you continue to hold that position for an extended period of time. It means that, you're in there, you're tactically in that position, probably in an overweight position, maybe for 6, 12, 18 months, and then you're getting prepared to then take off that extra money that you've put in as the trend starts to show signs of softening or weakness, or you're starting to see divergences in price versus strength. And volume, and then you start to take that money off the table later on down the track. So it's just something that I thought I might share with our listeners today, that this is a very handy way to scratch out another couple of percent, is add to your winners, add to strength, do the things that feel physically, uncomfortable for you, because in the stock market, that's the way that you make money. And that's why it's so hard for others to consistently make money and outperform, because it is so counterintuitive to everything that naturally we accept as being prudent.
Absolutely. The topic of behavioral finance was first sort of studied and had a good number of studies come out on behavioral finance through the 90s and early 2000s. And we're about 20 years on from that now. Mm. And those studies show that there is clear human psychological behavioral patterns that don't end up with good investment returns. And the typical mindset is if a stock is going up, you want to sell it and take your money because I've made a profit, I don't want to lose it. Mm. And if you start making a loss, you hang on to it for too long because you want to make your money back, which is completely the wrong psychology. And in my mind, if you're going to be a successful investor, you need an investor's mindset instead of a consumer's mindset.
Correct.
Or yourself a really good financial advisor.
Or get yourself a really good financial advisor who has that mindset for you. Because Joel, what you're saying is totally counterintuitive.
Yeah.
If I'm at the supermarket and I am buying something at a certain price, something I buy all the time, I don't know, shampoo. I buy it for $10 a bottle or whatever it is. It's a big bottle. And then next week I see it's $15 a bottle. I don't say, great, it's going up, I'm going to buy some more.
No.
But that's what you're exactly what you're saying.
Correct.
With the stock market.
Yeah.
Because it's going up in price, therefore I need to buy more now. Because the price is likely to go up even further.
Yeah, I hear a lot of stock market experts talk about, well, if you know, if shampoo was cheap, you know, it was $100 today, and then it falls down to $50 tomorrow, you'd go and buy more. Well, you should do the same in the stock market. And I actually think that's absolutely the wrong thing to do, and it's the wrong analogy entirely.
Yep.
You know, you've got that consumer item, which is completely different to an asset, appreciating asset.
Mm-hmm.
So I just think that analogy is actually wrong.
And it's very different to what happens when a property bubble comes about, because a lot of the time people are buying property as it's getting higher and higher because it's almost like the FOMO.
Yep, absolutely.
Exactly. Whereas, and that's clear example of an investment or an industry which is based much more in that consumer mindset rather than an investor mindset.
But then it's going back again to the media. I mean, if something is in the media, people tend to freak out and panic. And I know that when the stock market has taken a dip, I go back to Joel and go, oh my God, what's happening? Like, what is going on? Like, I want to sell out everything and get out. And he's like,
the sky
is
falling.
Normal.
Exactly.
This is really normal.
Yeah, it
but
is.
Again, human psychology, you read the headlines and, you know, the average person freaks out.
Yeah,
I think so.
That's
I want to remove it all, and I'm scared, and I don't want to stay in it. And and how do I, you know, get an exit strategy to keep my money in place? So,
exactly. And most people have that consumer mindset because they haven't learned or been trained or experienced in the investor mindset. Mm. And the media is there to
manipulate,
generate clicks, and sell ads by holding people's interest.
Yeah.
And the way to hold interest for people that have a consumer mindset is to publish articles that promote it or feed on it or actually push those fear triggers.
Yeah, right.
So listening to the media is just
probably the worst thing you can do
if you're an investor.
Yeah.
So look, Paul Tudor Jones, he's very bullish on stocks. He thinks there could be an interest rate cut. We actually feel that that the next 12 to 18 months looks pretty good for stocks. Just circling back to Paul Tudor Jones, great documentary filmed in 1987 with him as the centerpiece called Trader Documentary. You can get it on, if you go on Google search, Paul Tudor Jones Trader Documentary on YouTube. It's a free download. Watch it. Fascinating insight into how a professional, you know, now worth $4.6 billion when he was starting off in his career, how he would go about running his business and making investment decisions.
Wow. Okay. Good tip.
Yeah.
Well, you know what you'll be doing on your Friday night? Download a copy of that.
Woo!
No, but good
Don't
advice.
Watch Die Hard again. Watch Paul Tudor Jones. Yes.
Paul Tudor, and Joel's other favourite is Wall Street.
Wall Street.
Amongst others.
Yeah. All right, guys. Well, look, we're going to move on to our last segment for today, and that is You Can't Be Serious. And now I know that everyone's got a You Can't Be Serious. Louis, we're going to throw to you for your first one.
Excellent. There is an airline in the UK called Thomas Cook. They have a membership program called Cook's Club that they're really promoting, and part of that promotion is to paint the side of the aeroplane with I Love Cook's Club.
Okay.
Oh.
The problem is in Cook's, the O is on one of the exit doors, and when the exit door moves, it blocks out a little part of the O.
So what does it say, Louis?
I Heart Cox Club. I do love what the airline said about it, because they did say, it goes without saying that it is an accident, but it is a pretty good way to highlight where the emergency exit is.
Yeah.
I actually think that's very good publicity.
Yeah, that's right. Run well for the played. Cocks.
Yeah.
I'm sure they were cocking off about their strategy.
Very good.
Okay, who's up next?
Oh, Brett, you go ahead, mate.
Okay, so everyone on the planet's probably heard of Donald Trump's love of Twitter and how it's virtually unfiltered. He gets on it and it goes out before it's even been critiqued or reviewed. Well, he had a reasonably funny faux pas recently when he was over in the UK. So his tweet came out, and it sounds all well and good if you're just hearing it. It says, I meet and talk to foreign governments every day. I just met with the Queen of England, and he puts in brackets UK in case we didn't know, the Prince of Wales, the PM of the United Kingdom, the PM of Ireland, the President of France, and so on. The part of it that when you read it doesn't make is quite funny is that Prince of Wales, the Wales is spelt with an H.
Oh.
And the responses are really what's quite funny.
Prince of Wales.
Yeah.
Wow.
So a typical Trump faux pas.
Prince of Wales, King of Dolphins.
Yeah. So that's the responses are what really takes the cake too.
His PR team wouldn't be happy.
So there's a spoof Prince Charles account that just says, ah, very funny Donald Trump. Did you do that on porpoise? Royal Albert Hall have a Prince of Wales room, which they renamed for the day and took all of the portraits off the wall and put Whale Prince up. But probably the best one was the news website Wales Online that changed the title and their logo for the day.
Oh, that is great.
Oh, wow.
Joel, do you have any to top or
no? No.
Can't beat that one.
Well, look, thanks, guys, for all your input today and for our listeners again for tuning in. And have a fabulous week, everyone. And we'll be back next week to do it all again.
Looking forward to it. Thanks, Steph.
Thanks.
You've been listening to this week's episode of The Investor Exchange. To access this episode's show notes, go to theinvestorexchange.com.au and follow us on Facebook at The Investor Exchange for updates on our latest episodes. This show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. Before making any investment decision, contact United Global Capital by emailing ugc.net.au for a personalised, no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Or alternatively, email us at info@ugc.net.au.